generated a considerable increase in profit and revenue. During the course of the year, we reimagined our business, and reimagining our business is something, by the way, we do just about every month, if not every week around here. So, Nick, take it away.
First, like many of you, we are not surprised by this continued consolidation. We expect these companies to monetize the value of their newly acquired titles via scripted and unscripted content. The sector should end up with four, maybe five players emerging, and the winners will largely be dependent on their IP. We've discussed in the past how one of the biggest acquisition drivers for streamers is live rights.
You know, the NIL program offers WWE more opportunity than any other brands who are partnering with these collegiate athletes because it is such a recruiting tool.
Great. Thank you.
Steven, just quickly on the international large-scale events, why just limit it to two? Let's see how it looks in the next couple of months.
Thank you.
We have a special pile driver ready for you from the other
I bet you do.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of WrestleMomics Radio. I'm Brandon Thurston, broadcasting live and on demand from Buffalo, New York, where today is Sunday, February the 6th, 2022. It is early February. This is our first program of February, which means this is time. It's time for the look back on the prior, well, not 12 months, but the entire year of 2021 for WWE. Joining me to do that is Chris Gall. Hello.
It's great to be here. And yeah, Brandon, we have a jam-packed episode as we're going to thoroughly break down the Q4 financials and 2021 financials of WWE and highlights from the earnings call that was this past Thursday, including conversations about Peacock and percentages, conversations about the NIL program, and much more, including Stephanie chanting, "We want pizza." So,
mm-hmm. Yes. This is an episode that I will often go back and listen to through the archives. A lot of the old WrestleMomics Radio episodes that are covering the full year annual report. So is it clear that WWE does a quarterly report, right? But when they do this one that covers the final quarter of the year, in SEC terms, they don't put out a quarterly report for the final quarter. They put out an annual report. And oftentimes in the past, this is where we've gone into some pretty good detail and reflecting on the year that was in WWE finances. So this is a very permanent record that we're about to record here. Chris Gall, are you ready?
Never been more ready.
Okay. So, where shall we begin? I also completed a pro wrestling industry report for the third consecutive year that you can get access to through Patreon and through PayHip. We'll plug that some more later. But that, as usual, consumed my January. And maybe one of these days we'll go over some of the content that is contained in that report. But WWE on Thursday in its earnings report reported $1,095,000,000 in revenue. That is the most ever it has ever recorded. Revenue growth has been pretty consistent. However, growth in net income has been it's been fairly consistent in the last few years. I prefer to look at net income as a profitability metric. There is no one metric called profit. There are various profit metrics. WWE likes to focus on adjusted EBITDA because it doesn't include stock compensation and some other things. I'm not totally sure why they do. They do that for comparability reasons, and I do believe it is what they focus on internally. But I focus on net income because that is the final measure of profit after taxes and depreciation and amortization and stock compensation and what have you. And that measured in 2021 at $180 million, the most net income in any year in WWE history. Now, If you adjust that for inflation, though, they're not as profitable as they were in the Attitude Era, right? If you adjust for inflation. Isn't that right, Chris Gull?
No, they are still more profitable
still, than the Attitude Era. That can't, no, but they were way more popular in the Attitude Era. How can that be?
Because we are in the world of TV rights and large-scale international events, Brandon, that bring a lot of income in.
So proud of you. That's exactly right. WWE, as MJ from NJ pointed out, WWE is benefiting from the ultimate tailwind. They barely have to move forward and provide their own energy. Yes, I know that people at WWE work very hard at their jobs. However, they have an ultimate tailwind at their back in the form of live TV rights that are exploding in value over the last decade or so. So a good quarter for them. I mean, a good report for them. They beat on earnings. So what does that mean? They had an EPS. I don't understand a lot of things about how the stock market works and the way that people break down the numbers, but they use this metric called EPS, which stands for earnings per share ratio, which is just the number of shares, which is about 76, 77 million. In this case, we're looking at diluted shares, which is like 80 some odd million. You divide all the shares by the net income for the period, and you get the earnings per share ratio. So it's a way to measure profit, balancing for the number of shares that are in the company. Analysts expected that EPS number to be 52 cents. They reported 76 cents. In other words, they were a lot more profitable than the average analyst, stock analyst, expected. Now, stock analysts, they cover a lot of different companies. They don't spend all their day and night focusing on WWE and other wrestling companies like I do. I was pretty close, 68 cents. This is, I don't know, this is the third quarter in a row where I was closer than the average stock analyst. And I think I was higher than any of them as well, at least according to my automated Thomson Reuters report that I get through E-Trade. They were beating on earnings. Now, they beat on earnings the last three quarters as well, and the stock did not respond as favorably as it did. We'll get to that in a moment. On revenue, they were pretty close. I always see what I think are these automatically generated articles from like places like Seeking Alpha, where they say they beat on earnings, but they were short on revenue. I don't know. They were like, you know, $16 million short on revenue out of 310. That doesn't seem like that big of a deal to me. So everybody's pretty close on revenue, because revenue is pretty easy, relatively speaking, to anticipate. What's hard to anticipate is what everything costs, and that's where you get profit from, of course. Stock price. I think on Friday morning, after some analysts' reports came out, is what I'm guessing happened here. I have seen the JP Morgan and the North Coast and the Morgan Stanley report. I don't know if there are any others, but Friday morning, the stock price did jump by 10% on the day. There wasn't any strong aftermarket trading that I saw while just after the report came out, which was Thursday at about 5. But by the morning, the stock price was back up over $50. And I don't know, can we pull this up here? Are you investing in W stock, Chris Gull?
I am not currently, no.
You're not currently investing in W stock. I've never invested in W stock. But I do have things like Netflix.
I'm a previous investor, but no longer.
Yes. Do you have any plans to initiate any such positions in the next 72 hours?
I do not.
Okay. So if we look at, I just want to look at, you know, what did the stock do relative to sort of recent history? They're at $51 at the close of the market on Friday. So they are higher than they were a year ago at this time, which is where they were at $47. I'm curious, if I go so far back as to say, you know, what was the stock price on the day before Barrows and Wilson were fired? It was, let's see, it was 59. Google is not showing me every single day, but about a week before Barrows and Wilson were fired on January 24th, 2020, before the pandemic, the stock price was $59. And we've briefly seen WWE get that high. Wall Street Bets helped. In late October, it did get up to $60. But the stock price is still below where it was just before Barrios and Wilson left. We'll get into some more depth about why the stock is priced the way it is. But we'll get into some detail here. We're going to go through a number of audio clips and things of that nature. One of the big highlights, though, was Peacock, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, because this year of 2021, well, last year was, we had Peacock in every quarter, correct? It was in late quarter one, Q1?
So the deal was made in January. The deal went into effect in March. So okay. That was all in Q1. So what we had in Q1 was a lot of upfront payments from NBCU to WWE for the transfer of the IP. I'm guessing that was because of the transfer of the library. So we have a really heavy network line in Q1, and it's been not as heavy ever since.
So this was the year of the Peacock, and we got a lot of numbers with that, percentage numbers, and it was a highlight of the earnings call.
Yes. Just for reference, so the Peacock deal only affects people in the U.S., as people internationally listening may know. No longer can we in the U.S. subscribe to the WWE Network as a standalone service. You have to subscribe to it through Peacock, where you get it for either $5 or commercial free for $10 a month. But the peak in the U.S. for subscribers was back in Q2 2018, where the U.S. peaked at 1.3 million subscribers. Q4 2020, last quarter that we have a reported quarter for the WWE Network subscribers, it was 1.1 million. So to give you some idea of what the maximum U.S. audience was, it was 1.1 million at the end, 1.3 million for WrestleMania in 2018. But Nick Khan, as we kind of expected, gave us some percentage differences for what certain PLEs did versus their 2019 or pre-pandemic edition.
Yeah, and we'll actually run this down. 2021 on Peacock versus 2019 on WWE Network. For Money in the Bank, it was up 25%. SummerSlam, up 30%. Extreme Rules, which was in September, up 20%. The Saudi event, up 75%. And he said our 2019 event there, but there were two. Survivor Series, almost 25%. Royal Rumble 2022, 45% against 2020. There was 3.5 million plus paid Peacock subscribers have watched WWE content since the move in March. And that does align with Matt Bologna's From the Puck report in January.
Mm-hmm. So his report was not baloney.
Anyway. Very interesting. I'd still like to see hard numbers. I'm not sure if like you were able to see those, but actual hard numbers of
we won't be seeing any hard numbers. No. But this is encouraging, right? I mean, I heard a lot of people say when this deal was made that look, they're sort of abandoned and there was no clean transition, right? Like I think we're both W Network subscribers at the end.
Yes. Yep.
We didn't. It's not as if we suddenly had Peacock accounts. They shut down our account and we had to manually deliberately go into Peacock and create an account and give them our credit card information and tell them to charge us $5 or $10 a month. So we could become Peacock subscribers and get access to the WWE PLEs and library content. So a lot of skepticism, at least among this sort of wrestling fan podcast culture about, you know, they're not going to convert all 1.1 million. Well, I don't know if they did. The Bologna report, the Matt Bologna report did say that they converted. I forget what it was. It was like a million or something like that. But look, the viewership of these pay-per-views, which they're no longer called premium live events, is substantially higher by double digits. I don't think he was skipping over any here, right? He did cover Backlash last time. So yeah. WrestleMania, there was one before WrestleMania in 2021 that they did. They might've given us numbers, but anyway, so there's WrestleMania, which I believe they have called the most viewed WrestleMania ever. There's what was right after WrestleMania was Backlash. And then I think Money in the Bank and then SummerSlam. You can check in a pay-per-view schedule. Thank you. Extreme Rules in September, the Saudi event in October, Survivor Series in November, no event, no PLE in December, and then Royal Rumble in January and day one as well. He called day one on the call, he being Nick Khan, if you don't know, the WWE president and chief revenue officer, called the day one a huge success because of, you know, they anticipated an opening in the sports calendar. They turned out to be right. He called it more highly viewed than any December pay-per-view in the WWE Network history. So, and this is what's the lowest delta here is plus 20%. Can you confirm that they have not left out any pay-per-view here?
No, because they, let's see here. Yeah, no, because they canceled TLC for that day one event. So, yeah, it doesn't look like that they left anything out.
Yeah.
Hell in a Cell? Actually, yeah.
True. Maybe I would guess if they did leave Hell in a Cell out, what month was Hell in a Cell in?
June. Yeah, at least that's what the one CBS article I'm reading. So I'm just double checking on that. It was June 20th, 2021.
That might have. I don't want to say too definitively here because that was June. They might have mentioned it in the previous call. Anyway, if they are leaving any of them out, I'm guessing it's just because they're not as impressive as the others. The lowest number we've got here is 20%. So more people are watching this.
That was the last event at the Thunderdome, the last premium live event at the Thunderdome. So
I see. And what we're looking at here, beginning with Money in the Bank, are all events that have happened since the return to touring, because Money in the Bank was the second event back on the road after the SmackDown. So this is good. I've seen some people, including Brandon Ross from Lightshed, talk about how this is a good thing because there's more people watching this content. And maybe that has a downstream effect to if you're watching this, there's more likelihood that people are going to be engaged in the weekly content in Raw and SmackDown. And that helps fortify their TV ratings. Helping their TV ratings helps their live TV rights value going forward. Maybe that's happening. The thing about these premium live events, though, is that we've seen pay-per-view is this product that's proved to be quite demand inelastic in terms of the price. Just like the cable bundle, you can raise the price on these cable customers, especially the older ones, and they're never going to cancel unless you really become reckless. And we saw at the end, you know, pay-per-views were priced at about $65. AEW is still in the pay-per-view business. It's my assessment that Barrios and Wilson, the former co-presidents who were behind the W Network strategy, that they miscalculated they misunderstood the product somewhat, the pay-per-view product, in that it was not a product that had as much as many extra customers to capture by lowering the price as they anticipated. I believe too that it was not helped by the creative over the years that it was launched. You know, it was launched in early 2014 and it stalled by 2018. And I think the creative got worse over that time. And we saw that in a lot of consumer metrics too. We saw ticket sales, merchandise sales, product licensing, web search, all those things go down over those years from 2017 onward. So I think, you know, the W Network, they believed that they were going to capture 3 to 4 million subscribers worldwide. They got about halfway there. You can't go back. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. But I think that these events are being under-monetized. That's sort of revisionist history, though. Again, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, so you might as well sell these events to a much wealthier partner, NBC Universal. NBC Universal is something like a $200 billion market capital company. What's WWE's market capital, Gullo?
Now I got to look it up. I didn't have that handy. I have a lot of stuff handy today, including the definition of OIBDA and EBITDA.
Oh, good. Good. This is impromptu WrestleMania Jeopardy. What is WWE's market capital?
$3.92 billion.
Exactly. Just under $4 billion. So Comcast is whatever 200 divided by 4 is a lot bigger a company than WWE is. So they have resources at a far greater scale. They can afford to overpay now for the sake of the investment in streaming, which is what they're doing with Peacock. And that's what that's the deal that Nick Khan made. Anyway, so that's what's happening with Peacock. And that's a positive story. I expected a more negative story come out of live events, but a lot more positive than I expected. I was expecting live events to report an $8 million loss. I was way wrong. They reported a $1.4 million operating income. They were profitable in their live events division. And their live events division, even when you exclude, of course, the pandemic era was not profitable for them. They didn't run any ticketed live events during it. But even in the last quarters before the pandemic, in 2018 Q3, in 2019 Q3, in 2019 Q4, all pre-pandemic quarters, live events division by itself lost money. Lost in 2019 Q3, lost $4 million. In the other two quarters I mentioned, they lost $1 million. So I was expecting another loss, but they posted a $1.4 million gain in operating income. That's driven by 48 live events in the quarter, averaging 5,200 paid attendees. So that was pretty close there. What I underestimated were the ticket prices, and maybe I was overestimating. I have to look. Maybe I was overestimating the cost too. But that's giving us a pretty good idea, I think, going forward of what WWE's average attendance is going to be like. And if you look at it, is down from the last pre-pandemic Q4 2019, where they did 5,800. So one could say the holiday tour was not as successful. They ran a similar number of events too. In 2019 Q4, they ran 50 events in North America. In this quarter, they ran 48 live events. So it's a very similar number. Lower average attendance. So of course, lower total attendance with two fewer events and an average attendance that is 600 lower. So there's that. That aligns with my growing narrative that WWE is having increasing challenge in trying to get consumers to pay directly for its product. Peacock viewership is up. People are subscribing to Peacock, not just for the WWE network, but for Lord knows what. That's on Peacock, the Olympics, The Office, whatever. International attendance, by the way, in the quarter was down. They ran far fewer events internationally. They only ran 9 versus 20 in 2019. I'm sure that's pandemic related. They had a much more limited international tour, but I think they just went to the UK again. But the average attendance was down. Despite running fewer events, the average attendance was down to 3,700 in Q4 versus the Q4 of 2019, where it was up to 4,300. Of course, that doesn't include the Saudi Arabia Crown Jewel event. So as I digress to my point, I think there's some challenges with getting people to pay for this product. Sounds like, I haven't studied this, but it sounds like a narrative that I've heard around Impact or Total Nonstop Action, as it was once called, where their ratio of television viewership to what they were able to get on pay-per-view was quite a disparity. Lots of people, maybe a million people or so, were willing to watch their TV program that was part of a bundle that you have cable for all sorts of reasons. If wrestling disappeared, you would still have cable. But that was not converting very much to pay-per-view. WWE is a way bigger scale, and there are a lot of differences there. But people are willing to watch the train wreck but not pay for it is sort of what I think is happening here. average ticket price was, in this quarter, was $63 in North America. North America here refers to the U.S. and Canada. $63 compared to $61 in 2019's Q4. So that sounds like inflation. Average ticket price. This is good to know, too, for the sake of understanding the business going forward. How much had the ticket price gone up? We have Q3 where the average ticket price was $75 in that tremendous Q3 that they had in the return to touring. Q3 is July, August, and September, which is the first 3 months of the return to touring. The average ticket price in Q2 was $100 and some odd because it only contained WrestleMania. That's off the chart here that we're looking at here on YouTube. So this is a good indication of what it's going to be like going forward. Both in terms, you know, this was really an informative quarter in terms of understanding what their average attendance is going to be like, in terms of understanding what their average ticket price is going to be like, and in terms of understanding their consumer products business a little bit better. Again, the Q3 and Q2 are anomalies. Q2 only had WrestleMania in it, so it had, you know, a tremendous merchandise sales per capita. Q3 had pent-up demand benefits. Average merch spend per person per paid ticket was $14 in Q3 in the pent-up demand quarter. It's down to $12.39. And that is up substantially from where they were in the last pre-pandemic Q4, where it was $9. Now up to $12, almost $12.50. So that's informative going forward. And then what we really saw, did you remember this, Golo? Like when they went off the road, when you go off the road for the pandemic, you no longer have merch stands to sell merch at.
Yep.
But online orders really grew.
Yes. And that was, I believe Frank Riddick made a comment in the earnings call that with being on the road that, and you know, the pandemic spending slowing down is why they saw online purchases go down in Q4.
And that's an occurrence that I can't really wrap my head around, that online merchandise sales offset, not completely, but almost completely offset the loss of venue merchandise. I guess I view venue merchandise sales as this sort of spontaneous purchase that people don't plan for. So I don't see how online merchandise orders could have replaced that, because it's not as if you go, okay, I'm going to buy a Roman Reigns shirt, but I'm going to wait until the event to do it. I don't feel like that's a common thing. And then the pandemic happened, so we're not going to go to the live event. So I'm going to order some merchandise online instead. I just can't wrap my head around that, but the numbers bear that out, that something resembling that happened. And now with the pandemic not over, but touring back on the road, orders in Q4 were 164,000, down from 234,000 in 2020 Q4. Again, 164 down from 234. And actually in Q4, so usually we see a Q4 increase relative to the other quarters, probably because of Christmas and the holidays. Q4 2019 was 225,000 orders with no pandemic. So almost concerningly down in Q4 of this year, or when I say this year, I mean 2021. Again, maybe supporting this narrative that, I don't know, do people want to go out of their way to pay for this product? I don't know. But you look at the average revenue spent, that's been pretty strongly consistent. Back in 2019, it was in the high $40 range. And then since the pandemic, it went up early in the pandemic to $50, high in the $50 per order. And then the beginning of this year, $60, $70 in Q2 with WrestleMania in there. I don't know if WrestleMania is relevant, but in the 70s and 60s and here in Q4, in the high, you know, $67 was the average order price, revenue per online order. So take that for what you will. Is it the replica belts? There's no more Bray Wyatt. I think they're still monetizing Bray Wyatt, though, right?
When I was at the live event in December, that was here in Buffalo, New York, Sasha Banks t-shirts were heavily pushed, as well as Roman Reigns shirts and Drew McIntyre shirts. So there, and they had that where you have now, where you can just order it from your seat, and somebody will bring it to you, other than just standing in a merchandise line.
Right. Well, that's a good idea, because that's time consuming. You don't want to miss the show, and lines can get long. yeah. How do you do that? Do you like go onto an app? Go onto like a WWE app or something?
Yeah. Yeah, they have like I think it's on WWE Shop, but like I think there's a live event tab or something, and all that. I can't remember exactly because I didn't do it, but I remember them giving you, Byron Saxton was giving instructions how to do it.
you didn't do it because you hate WWE, and you got in for free, in fact.
I did get it for free. I had a friend that had a couple free tickets. But no, I don't hate WWE. I just I don't buy a lot of wrestling t-shirts. And if I do, they're usually Legend t-shirts or the WrestleNomics t-shirt that you can actually get.
You didn't buy that either. I sent it to you.
I was given that free, but I would buy it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I don't know. That's interesting to see how these economics played out through the pandemic and how they're changing as touring is back on the road. So product licensing revenue. What is the product consumer products licensing revenue line consist of? I'm going to ask you, but I'm going to review the three. There's three revenue lines that they report within consumer products, which we just talked about: venue merchandise,
yes,
and e-commerce.
Venue merchandise
and e-commerce. Okay. Those are obviously online merchandise sales. But then there's a third one, product licensing.
Product licensing.
What does that consist of? What are the big products in that category?
So that would be video games. That would be action figures. Absolutely. That would, yeah. And all the other stuff they put their name on. And we had two super chats. Tim, we're going to leave your super chat towards the end because it's a bigger topic, but we will address it. But MJ had a super chat of, online average spend probably higher than in person. So
it definitely is. It's by multiples. Well, per person, this is per head, right? But it probably still is, right? This is per person. So this is including people who didn't buy any merchandise at all. This, what was in Q4, $12.39. So about $12, almost 12 and a half. Yeah, we don't know. They don't report the number of venue merch sales, like the number of sales. So hard to break down for sure. But I would agree with you there. So what I wanted to say was this product licensing revenue line from 2017 onward had been an annual decline. Don't blame it on the pandemic because it was down in 2018 and it was down in 2019. It had been in 2017. Up to $52 million, down to $46 million in 2018, down to $43 million in 2019, and in 2020, $42 million. Back up to $52 million in this quarter. Hard to imagine why, for me, really. There is no video game yet they still made it to $52 million. I don't know if action figure sales are through the roof or there's some other deals here.
So this was, you got to remember, 2021 during the pandemic here was the year of the trading cards. And I don't know how much, we don't have breakdowns, but people, WWE trading cards were one of the things people were buying, hoping that they would go up into value. I remember watching these unboxing and it was mostly Pokemon cards and basketball and football cards. But
we're not talking about NFTs here, right?
Huh? What's up?
We're not talking about NFTs here, right? Because
we're talking legit collector trading cards.
Because they're NFT sales at this point. I'm not even sure if they would put NFTs in here or if they would put them in media. But I guess they would put them here because that sounds like a consumer purchase. But anyway, NFTs, they've only done Undertaker and John Cena. John Cena ones were not good. The Undertaker sales were all sold out, but we're still talking about a pretty limited inventory. So they're going to do NFTs. They're going to do an NFT marketplace probably this year, maybe soon. But yeah. Trading cards.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a small piece of the pie, but I know that was a trend in 2021 and towards the end of 2020 was trading cards.
Okay.
The popularity of buying them, hoping you get a rare card that's worth a lot of money. And
were there especially high numbers of like action figure releases or something?
I don't know. I believe 2021, though, was the release of the Zodiac figure. it could have been 2020, but yeah, I mean, I'm not 100% sure on that. Would they consider the online games in here?
Yes. Yes. Mobile games, console games.
The mobile absolutely. Games. Yeah. Like the mobile games. I know they bragged about that in the earnings call.
Stephanie did mention that.
And they did say the trading card deal with Panini as well, mm-hmm. which was last year.
Yes. I believe they left Topps, right?
Yes. I believe. Yeah. They were Topps. Yeah.
And then Topps was just acquired by, it escapes me. I don't know if the Panini deal is in effect yet. Have they put out any cards under the Panini brand yet?
I'm not sure. You know, some of the is MJ does bring up the DraftKings deal too. I don't know if that would count on this.
Yeah, I don't know if that's media. That's is that media ads and sponsors, or would that be consumer products? Not sure. But so they do in their quarterly report, to the extent that they did put in their earnings press release that it was attributed to. I would have to look. They didn't call out anything in particular. It was, I think they attributed the increase in the consumer products division to the increase in product licensing sales. So that could be anything within product licensing. But as you point out, anytime you put out an action figure for one of the many personas portrayed by Ed Leslie, you can expect a lot of activity around that. So Ed Leslie action figures, I know, are a big hit with many people. So
the Panini deal actually starts this year. Some other things that were brought up in the chat, though, was the DLC packs for the WWE 2K Battlegrounds video game, you know, and some Fanatic stuff, too. So, I mean, they definitely merchandise a lot of licensed a lot of stuff. We are in the Nikon era of IP. So,
And, you know, I was saying, I think with John Pollock, and maybe with MJ too in the preview, that I see this is an area that Nikon can do a lot to add incremental growth to with all these deals. So that's part of it. But what they also mentioned here too, which I don't think we're going to mention elsewhere, is he mentioned 12, over a dozen scripted and unscripted series or pieces of content that they're going to announce soon. So a lot of teases of announcements here. I wonder too, what was brought up to me by someone who I was talking to is what's Nikon's success from? What is his, you know, I imagine a lot of it is connections. He's an agent at CAA for a long time, and I'm sure he made a lot of important connections there. Maybe it's a lot of Nikon is able to get meetings that maybe nobody in WWE up to that, up until he was there, were able to get. But it was just to me that, you know, maybe the success of the Nachka Khan, his sister, is what helps this a lot too. Not just that he's been a successful lawyer and talent agent by himself, but that maybe these two siblings have really built on each other's success. Nanashka Khan is a successful TV producer, and she is the creator, right, of the Young Rock series based on the life of Dwayne Johnson. So
I was just going to say, I think when it comes to Nikon, it's marketability, right? Like when you're an agent of somebody, you want to literally squeeze as much profit out as you can of that individual. How can we market the individual in so many different things? And can they sponsor this? Can they do this? Can they do that? And I think that mindset is how we're seeing license deals that we've never seen before at WWE, really outside the box stuff, because Nikon is treating the WWE product like it's his client. And okay, well, you can do trading cards and you can do video games. And I think that that's the reason why he's been so successful when it comes to these product licensing, because he's treating it as it's a client to get the most out of. And we see, like, I mean, I didn't even know, I had no idea that they had a stake in the Rowdy's Places on ESPN, but he did bring that up in the earnings call, which now kind of makes sense because Kurt Angle is on one episode and I see Paul Heyman's on the one that just aired and Undertaker's going to be on one.
You're talking about the Rousey's Places ESPN Plus series. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's called Rowdy's Places and he called it Ronda's Places or something like that. I think it's called Rowdy's Places.
Okay.
But it's supposed to be like a combat sports take on Peyton Manning's Peyton Places, but it is very WWE heavy. And he mentioned something about WWE being executive producers in that. So, which is interesting because it's an ESPN property.
Right. That's where I saw the clip of, it's Ronda Rousey, D-Von Dudley and Paul Heyman sitting in a ring in the ECW arena discussing ECW.
That is the one episode I haven't watched. I've watched the others. Very interesting. If you're a mixed martial arts person too, it's really good.
Who have been her guests?
She had, Hoist Gracie and Rainier Gracie on the first one about the birth of MMA.
When
she did the Kickboxing by the Bay episode, she had Daniel Cormier on there. She had Kurt Angle on an episode that was mostly about WWE, but a little bit about his amateur wrestling background. She had Dana White on an episode where they showcased the UFC Apex. You know, so, and listen, and I know Ronda Rousey is a very controversial figure right now. I'm not saying my, I approve of what she thinks. I just am an MMA fan and on top of wrestling. So it's just history, learning the history.
Has she had anybody on to discuss conspiracy theories yet?
Not yet. Okay. She had Larry Holmes on one about boxing too. It was really good.
Okay. I'm seeing here MJ in the chat helpfully points out Topps was acquired by Fanatics.
Okay.
And Griffin mentions that there's downloadable content in the 2K Battlegrounds game, which was their arcade console game from not 2021, but 2020, I think. So anyway. Moving on to this slide that we're looking at on YouTube, that is from their key performance indicators, where they always update you, investors, on what the AVOD numbers are. What is AVOD, Chris Golo? What does that stand for?
I want to say that's audio video on demand.
Ad supported video on demand.
Oh.
So this, they give two metrics here. Global hours viewed. Time, the amount of time people spent watching WWE content on ad-supported platforms across the internet, and then the number of views. Number of views I don't take as seriously because I think everybody measures a view on these platforms a little bit differently. And who knows what, you know, where are we talking about? 1 second, 3 seconds, 10 seconds, 30 seconds? I don't know. I look at our own analytics through YouTube, and I don't know what sense to make of views and how they are truly counted. But hours, that's more even across platforms. Time is time. Time is the ultimate unifier. And global hours viewed on AVOD platforms was down to 307 million hours in the quarter, down tremendously from the prior quarter, the lowest it's been since Q1 of 2019. This is an area of new media that has grown tremendously for WWE over time. But this is the lowest it's been in more than a year. They have these call-out labels pointing at these quarters saying Q4 2021, AVOD consumption was impacted by the absence of a premium live event in December, which presumably would coincide with an increase in activity here, and the removal of full matches on YouTube and Facebook. It almost makes it sound that they've stopped posting full matches on their platforms. But as I've been covering the YouTube data pretty closely, they're still definitely posting full matches. I don't know if they've taken down some full matches out of the archive. But a lot of their something like 70% of their views, I can't measure time, but I can measure views because those are publicly visible. Something like 70% of their views in a given period of time are of content that is at least older than a week ago. So a lot of their, at least YouTube activity, is from stuff that is not new content. So maybe they're taking down old full matches for some reason. Maybe it's a Peacock thing. I don't know. So if we look at just the YouTube views, and just isolate that, this is based on data from Social Blade. That is down, and it's been down. And maybe this is a pandemic effect too, just like sort of, you know, online merchandise sales were up during the pandemic. We saw in, let's see here. It's been, you would expect it to be sequentially up just because this is a new form of media that people are adopting more generally. As I swat at a gnat here. So it was up in 2020. It was way up in Q2 2020. 4 billion YouTube views, up from 2.6 billion in the same quarter of 2019, up 4.6 billion in Q3 2020, 3.6 billion in Q4 2020. We're still in this non-touring pandemic era in Q1 of 2021, and it's up year over year. Now that's compared to a quarter where it was mostly not in the pandemic era, up to 3.7 billion. But then in Q2 versus the first full quarter of the pandemic, it was down to $3.3 billion, down from $4 billion. And then it was down again, $3 billion even, down from $4.6 billion. And then in Q4, down to $2.3 billion, which is basically even to what it was in 2019. I'm wondering if YouTube is becoming a stable metric for them. I've given other rants in the past about how there are different metrics that we can look at related to WWE fan engagement have different sort of maturity levels. Now, I'm not talking about the maturity level of the people involved. I'm talking about the maturity of the form of product. So tickets are definitely, I don't know, the oldest form of consumer product, right? Yep. Tickets have been around for centuries, at least a century in pro wrestling. So that's not a form of new adoption, right? But TV ratings are an aging metric, I would say. People are doing, you know, people are watching linear TV less. The W Network was a young metric. Maybe was a young metric up to when we stopped getting numbers for it at the end of 2020, despite those numbers being stagnant and somewhat down. YouTube is a young metric, at least up to this point, where people are adopting YouTube, using YouTube in greater numbers generally. So you expect this number to be up. I don't want to downplay WWE's success. They're in YouTube, they're a massive channel on YouTube. They're one of the most popular channels on YouTube globally. And they've, you know, we're looking at a chart here showing the number of YouTube views for each year. This is sourced from Social Blade. You can't even see this data on Social Blade anymore because I've been covering it going back to 2018. They'll only show you going back to like mid 2018 right now. But we know that in 2015, they had 4 billion views. Then the next year in 16, they had 6 billion views. In 2017, 6.6. 2018, 10 billion views. 2019, down to 9.2 billion views. I still don't have it straight what effect India or maybe some geo-blocking might be having on this. But in 2020, the year of the pandemic, 15 billion, up from 9.2 in the prior year. 10 billion the year before that. 15 billion in 2020. And now 12.2 billion. So that is still their second biggest year ever on YouTube. And that's well up from 2019. But yes.
Do you think the correlation of, you know, especially in 2020, the empty arena product not being something that you needed to watch live, like because it, you know, there, it was a different, it came off differently than an event in front of live fans, that people were just like, oh, I'll watch the highlights on YouTube. Like, was that probably, and you're probably still seeing that in 2021. I brought that up before that. I think there is a WWE viewing base that's solely YouTube.
I'm sure to some extent. Yeah. I don't know, if you look at the quarters here that we're looking at in this chart on YouTube that looks at the quarterly YouTube view performance, what we see in the non-touring quarters is especially high. And and that's the time with the Thunderdome and the PC. You know, and that's probably a time where people are working from home more. So I don't know if that's a factor. Who knows? We are seeing this is a monthly breakdown here of just showing that, yeah, YouTube views have been down year over year on a monthly basis since April 2021. So that's still in the Thunderdome era. Now, remember, the Thunderdome era ended in mid-early July, and it was down year over year before that, but it's been especially down since July, though. We have conditional formatting here, and you can see the red differences get redder beginning in July. So there might be something to that people were in a sense checking it out on delayed viewing on YouTube. And then once crowds returned, maybe they started to check it out more so on traditional TV, whereas they hadn't before. That's a plausible theory. However, we have some news from the world of YouTube. It's not as if the world of YouTube is slowing down.
No, not at all. This is actually from the Hollywood Reporter by Alex Wepper. Now, YouTube ad revenue tops $8.6 billion, beating Netflix in the quarter. YouTube topped Netflix in terms of quarterly revenue, with the Google-owned video platform delivering $8.6 billion in advertising revenue in Q4. The company said Tuesday, for fiscal 2021, YouTube delivered $28.8 billion in advertising revenue. In the same quarter a year earlier, YouTube delivered $6.9 billion in advertising revenue, underscoring the continued explosive growth of the platform. For comparison, Netflix delivered $7.7 billion in revenue in Q4 in 2021 compared to $6.6 billion a year earlier.
So what was YouTube's Q4 revenue?
YouTube's Q4 this year was $8.6
billion. $8.6 billion.
Yeah.
Not all of that's ad revenue. Probably the overwhelming majority of it is. They do say that that is ad revenue, in fact. Delivering $8.6 billion in advertising revenue compared to Netflix in the same quarter, same time period, I believe. I think their Q4 is calendar year for both of them, right? I own both of these companies, by the way, Google and Netflix, for full disclosure. $7.7 billion to $8.6 billion. That's astonishing to me that sort of the average revenue, the average amount of money that you get per person or per viewer, I guess in this case, is going to be way higher for Netflix, right? I guess the time spent, I know we had that gauge chart. I imagine the time spent for YouTube is a little bit higher than for Netflix. But the fact is that, you know, Netflix, what's the rate on Netflix now? $12 a month or something like that? I know that's
$12.99, I think, or yeah, maybe it's even gone up. But they're all subscription based, where YouTube is ads. Plus, they have, we talked about it last week. There is some subscription tiers and whatnot, but I think that might be the difference.
If you're a viewer in the U.S., you're being monetized at a way higher rate than somebody in just about any other country, especially if you're watching from a country that doesn't have as strong an economy. The ad sales just aren't as strong and just aren't as lucrative as they are in the U.S. So I can see that in our YouTube analytics, and that, you know, U.S. viewers are monetized at a higher rate, but subscriber revenue is in my view, like such a superior model to what you're able to monetize through ads, that the time being spent on the YouTube platform just must be huge. So there's that. YouTube is still in great shape. And I think what probably was really changed YouTube, right, is sort of this Facebook thing, where you look at Facebook in its transition from desktop to mobile. And what I think we're seeing here is a similar sort of, I don't know, the way that people consume it has changed and has accelerated their ability to generate revenue in that. I think up until the last couple of years, YouTube is, I would be interested to know what their data is, that probably the majority of their engagement up until last couple of years, I would bet, is mostly desktop or mobile. And now I think a lot of people are watching YouTube through their television. Yep. And that's the big difference.
I know every morning, Monday through Friday, I watch a YouTube show.
On your television?
Yes. It's about 15 minutes long. It's called Good Mythical Morning with Rhett and Link. And actually, I saw a graph where they're worth $30 million with all the YouTube revenue that they get. I watch it every morning. It's habited viewing for me. It's about 10 to 15 minutes. I think they're funny. They do a lot of cool, fun stuff on there when it comes to food or science experiments, stuff like that. It's fun.
Yeah. And that's probably a huge difference in time, right? Because you're much more likely, you're going to spend a lot more time playing something on your TV than you are playing something on your computer or on your phone or on your tablet. So I'm sure that's accelerated their time tremendously. And YouTube just has this, Netflix has made a tremendous pivot into making their own content, right? And there's a lot of high quality content on there. YouTube just has this, I would be curious to just add up all the hours of content that they have. It's massive.
Something that YouTube has done recently is they've seen the success of other platforms and they've integrated in theirs. I believe they have YouTube Reels, which is pretty much their version of TikTok, which if you notice with TikTok content, it just gets transferred over to YouTube and Instagram and even Facebook. It's the same stuff, but they've also, they put a lot of free movies now that you could just watch on YouTube with ads. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, a little bit older movies, but probably the same stuff you would get on like Tubi TV and stuff like that. There was another thing I was going to say. I can't remember. They took in success from other either streaming or social media platforms and they've integrated it into their own.
I mean, that's something that gets talked about a lot in sort of wider media conversation. And Facebook is usually the biggest culprit there. They just acquired Instagram, and now Instagram has acquired, you know, copied a lot of the products of Snapchat. That's where Stories comes from. But that's a very good point that everyone's copying TikTok, and usually the content that you see in the TikTok copycats have the TikTok logo in the corner.
It's the same from stuff. TikTok.
Yeah. But YouTube is doing shorts, which is their version of TikTok videos. And hey, yep. look at what we're doing right now. I think YouTube is copying Twitch, and hey, send us a super chat.
Yes.
That's a Twitch product. I don't know what it's called on Twitch because you don't spend much time there. But
that was yes. And they're pushing live streaming of video games. So that was yes. That was the other thing I was thinking of.
Absolutely.
From the success from Twitch. Yeah.
So that's a quick rundown of content. My favorite form of W content, in fact, WWE earnings calls. But now that's the report that came out at 4 o'clock-ish. I had to report an AEW rating at the same time. Fairly disappointing AEW rating. But then at 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Thursday, the real premium live event, the WWE earnings conference call featuring the real superstars of WWE, including new CFO Frank A. Riddick III, Chief Brand Officer Stephanie McMahon, new Senior Vice President of Investor Relations Seth Zaslow, the real superstar of WWE, Nick Khan, and of course, Chairman and CEO, Vince McMahon. So, I did some analysis of how much each executive talks over this conference call and over the prior five, but I really went all the way back to 2014, right? How far back did I go? Yeah, 2014. And Nick Khan has been doing more of the talking than anybody else here. On every one of these calls since Nick, I think what we're looking at here on YouTube is a chart from October 2020 and going forward. So that's the first Nick Khan conference call to the present. And he has done 27% or more of the words uttered, according to the transcript, 27% or more are his words being uttered. Stephanie McMahon has been talking a little bit more than usual lately. Who's been talking less than usual? Vince McMahon, who only uttered 2% of the words that were said on this conference call in this call and the previous call. The one before that, he uttered 4% of the words. The one before that, he uttered 2% of the words. Not that unusual for Vince McMahon to not talk that much on these earnings calls. He did get really talkative in early 2020, and he spoke 36% of the words in April 2020, the Q1 earnings call. He spoke 19% of the words in the February 2020, the Q4 call. Well, that was because he fired the co-presidents who used to do the talking for him. There's one, the October, which is the Q3 call in 2019. He was in Saudi Arabia for that one, so that's why that one is down at a zero. But, you know, normally he's in the 10% range, sometimes as high as 18%, sometimes as low as 3%, but mostly he's at or around 10%, and he's down to 2% lately. So he's not talking that much. He's talking less than usual. Dude got very upset with me for sharing this information.
Yes.
I've hit a new low. I've hit rock bottom. I'm terrible. What can I say? If you could, so is this unusual? I mean, is it aren't there plenty of other companies where the CEO barely ever talks? And by the way, what is Vince McMahon's position here? He's the chairman of the board of directors. He's the chief executive officer. He is the head of creative. He is the controlling shareholder. He holds preferred class shares that give him 10 times the voting power of everybody else that allows him to hold a minority of the shares while controlling the majority of the voting power. In essence, he owns the company. He's the majority owner of the company while not owning the majority of the shares, which is Mark Zuckerberg is the same thing, right? But anyway, I didn't grab like every company in the S&P 500 here or every company in the world, but I grabbed some companies that I think of as peers in a number of different ways for WWE. So I picked AMC, the theater company. I picked Sinclair Broadcasting, Disney, Live Nation. That's a live event business. Facebook/Meta. And Viacom, CBS. And I asked, let's look at 2021, the entire year. Let's look at those four earnings calls that these executives did. How much did the CEOs talk in the entire year of conference calls? And Adam, is it Adam Aaron? I'm sure there's some AMC enthusiasts who know this man well. The CEO of AMC, 73% of the words spoken on AMC earnings calls are from the CEO. Chris Ripley, the Sinclair CEO, 47%. Bob Chapek from Disney, 45%. Michael Rapino from Live Nation, 43%. Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook/Meta, 42%. Bob Bakish from Viacom CBS, 40%. Again, 73%, 47%, 45%, 43%, 42%, 40%. WCEO, 3%. So, I mean, whatever. Do you want Vince McMahon talking more if you're looking after the interests of WWE? Maybe not. But I think it says something about how much he defers to, in the past, George Berrios, and now even more so Vince McMahon when it comes to strategy. It's worth pointing out, Amazon has not had its CEO, if we're looking for comparisons here, Amazon has not had a CEO who has spoken on an earnings call since April 2019. So Jeff Bezos is no longer the CEO. Andy Jassy is now. And Jeff Bezos stopped talking on earnings calls in April 2009. Did I say 2019 before? 2009.
Yeah, that, I was just going to correct you, but then you read the line. So
yeah, I do that a lot where I leave out words or I say the wrong word that is in my brain. So please interrupt me when I do that. April 2009 was the last time an Amazon CEO spoke on an earnings call. More than 10 years ago. So they don't participate at all. But it makes me wonder if we have a CEO emeritus here in charge of WWE. Familiar with the term emeritus? Professor emeritus.
Well, emeritus, yeah, it is having retired but allowed to retain their title as an honorer. Emeritus professor of microbiology is an example. So almost like a figurehead, if you think about it.
Yeah. And look, I tend to believe this legend around Vince that I believe it is still true today, that this man works tirelessly 24/7, barely sleeps, works a lot. He's doing something a lot. I just can't imagine what it is. He apparently defers to Nick Khan on strategy a lot, which is fair enough. It's hard to imagine somebody who understands the business better, the media business better than Nick Khan. Yes, you're going to add something.
Yeah, this is a deeper topic for probably a different day. But the narrative is Vince creative is all Vince is at the end. It's what Vince wants, no matter how many people are on the creative writing team. Do you think a part of that now, especially lately, is because he knows a lot of that other business stuff is really pivoted towards Nick Khan and in some aspects, Stephanie, where he doesn't really have his hand probably in a lot of those pots when it comes to licensing deals and globalization and streaming and all that. So this is what he's got left and he's going to hold on to it. Well, here's his cold hands.
Here's the thing, though. Like, how involved? I'm very confident that he's dictating creative. Creative is being, the vision is being dictated by him. The general direction, the major decisions, probably the match results are being dictated by him.
Yeah, he is the highest influence in that department. But that is bar none.
Do we think he's involved in the day-to-day writing of the show? But when you hear reports that oh, the Raw script was torn up 3 hours before the show went to air. Is he tearing up a script that he was deeply involved in writing? I find that hard to believe.
I don't think it's like the 90s where he sits down with four people at his table in his, you know, in his house and everything. But I think that, yes, these writers are writing this stuff, but then they bring it to him. And if he just doesn't like it, he tells them to change it. I mean, you know, I'm sure he also has participation in some of these business deals. And I'm sure the Saudi deal doesn't happen unless he goes over there and meets with the officials. Because I'm sure, you know, a man of power meeting a man of power, I'm sure they hit it off. You know,
but Bix found some records showing how, showing record of some sort of contact between Berrios and somebody from the Saudi government. I think, I'm sure if Bix is listening, he can point it out, point out to us what I'm thinking of. Who knows? But, now we're going to go through some audio clips from the earnings call. And, here is the entirety of Vince McMahon's comments from Thursday.
Welcome everyone. As you know, we've generated a considerable increase in profit and revenue, with revenue over $1 billion, which is somewhat of a mark for us. During the course of the year, we reimagined our business, and reimagining our business is something, by the way, we do just about every month, if not every week around here. We're very, very flexible. Nick and staff are going to be talking about many of the key achievements that we've made, and that we obviously remain focused on the on our upcoming year of 2022, as well as years to come, with working toward record revenue again, as well as adjusted OIBDA and what have you. So our performance, we think, pretty much speaks for itself and speaks for the longevity we've had for so many years and the opportunities that are there for us, you know, to grow exponentially. So, Nick, take her away.
Adjusted OIBDA and what have you. It's about as surface level as it gets. It speaks for itself. Nick and Steph are going to talk about this stuff. So, probably the most newsworthy exchange here. There's some other stuff that I think is really interesting that we're going to dig into. But probably the most newsworthy hint that was dropped here is this exchange between Nick Khan and the Wells Fargo analyst Stephen Cahal. Where Stephen Cahal was basically asking about, now, we don't say the words Saudi Arabia on these calls. No. We say large-scale international event for some reason. I don't know why one would not want to say Saudi Arabia. Can you think of any reasons? Why don't they say Saudi Arabia here?
Because it's not a very politically correct nation.
What do you mean?
There's some controversial things.
But I watched Crown Jewel.
Women's rights and
I watched Crown Jewel.
Freedom of journalism
and Super Showdown. And it looks like a pretty low key country to me. Things seem pretty relaxed there when I watch the Saudi events on the W Network.
Yeah, you know what also did?
No, wait, Gull. Don't you remember the first event they did there, the Greatest Royal Rumble, where they aired that video about how progressive Mohammed bin Salman is and how he's changing the laws and women can drive now? Remember that?
Yeah. Progressive, like the yeah, no, there's still, unfortunately with Saudi Arabia, there's still a lot of rights that, you know, when it comes to freedom of speech and women that they do not have, that they should have. It should be equal rights for everybody. But they know this when they're talking to investors. And yes, the investors know that the shows are in Saudi Arabia, but it sounds better to say large scale international events. It's very, you know, buzzwords and, you know, safe for WWE executives to do this.
Now, wouldn't it be great if you could, while using that euphemism, large-scale international event, which is a euphemism for Saudi Arabia events. By the way, we should always remind people, these are not just events that are happening in Saudi Arabia for the fans there. These are events that are bought by the government. $50 million a year, $50 million per event, $100 million a year. That is what you call a controversy fee. That is my word for it. Wouldn't it be nice though, if you've invested in this euphemism, large scale international event, if you could have other large scale international events that were not in Saudi Arabia to say, look, no, these could refer to anything. Wouldn't that be great? Anyway, we've filibustered long enough here. Let's go to this exchange between Stephen Call. He's trying to understand whether or not there's going to be two Saudi events, and that's just being clarified for him. You know, so here's the clip.
Thanks. Maybe just first a couple of questions on the 2022 guidance. I'm wondering what type of media OPEX growth is implied in there. That's always a tough one to model. So any commentary on that? Second, sorry if I missed this, should we assume two large-scale international events?
And then Frank Riddick gives him an answer, and then Nick Khan at the end.
Great, thank you.
Stephen, just quickly on the international large-scale events, why just limit it to two? Let's see how it looks in the next couple of months.
So, is there going to be a third Saudi event per year? What's he talking about here?
I mean, that would be my guess. Now, this large scale, what I was going to bring up before you play the clip, this large scale international event term, that's fairly new, right? Probably this year, I would say.
I want to say I first started hearing it from Christina Salen, so it's at least that.
Maybe. Because they did do Super Showdown in Australia a couple years ago. That was a bigger event, but I think this is before this was a buzz.
So that was in the same quarter as the first Saudi event in 2018. I think, somebody suggested to me, well, maybe they're going to go back to Saudi, to Australia. I think what's happening here, and so somebody did hint to me that this does not, who would know something about this, hinted to me that this is not going to be a third Saudi event. So let's calm that down first. This is not going to be another $50 million. It's not going to be $150 million per year from the Saudi government that they're going to be collecting. I don't believe so. Let's take a look at the October press release that they put out about that used to say pay-per-view schedule has been changed to say premium live event schedule. And where are the gaps on this schedule? This is the 2022 schedule, and we have a gap in February, which is where Elimination Chamber is going to happen in Jeddah this month. Then there's no event in March, but I think there's just going to be no PLE in March. Then we got April with WrestleMania. We got May with something in Rhode Island. We got June with something in Chicago. We got July with Money in the Bank in Las Vegas at the stadium. We got SummerSlam in July, late July, in Nashville in the stadium. There's nothing in August, but there's two in July. So I think July is going to have no PLE in it. Let's come back to the September in a second. October has nothing listed here. That's probably going to be another Saudi event. And then November is going to have Survivor Series in Boston. Maybe there'll be nothing in December again. But they list here Saturday. Remember this, I'm sure we talked about this at the time. Saturday, September 3rd, or Sunday, September 4th, premium live event at a TBD location. Any guesses?
Saudi Arabia could be a guess, or England. Wasn't England thrown out there too, or at least the UK as a whole?
Purely speculation on my part. I think this is a UK show, perhaps a UK stadium show. By the way,
because we talked about it possibly running the same weekend as All Out.
Exactly. This is Labor. I'm going to check the calendar real quick. I'm pretty sure it is Labor Day weekend, which is when All Out has been for a number of years in a row. So I think that would be my expectation. And Nick Khan's hint makes it sound like there's going to be an announcement fairly soon. One would think so if you're going to announce a big show. That's going to happen in September. So I look for that email alert coming soon. So I think it's going to be a big UK show, perhaps a stadium show, that is going to be a pay-per-view. And it would be the first one since SummerSlam 1992.
I have an idea for a large scale international event. And I'm not
Do
sure.
You?
What about North what Korea? About India? What about India?
Well,
Because it is a market that they have been heavily invested in being more, you know, huge over there.
How have live events in the past performed in India?
I don't know that. I mean, I'm sure there is something in our, you know, data there on the Patreon, but
there's not before people go look. So when Jinder Mahal was WWE champion in 2017, they aligned that with a tour, an international tour where they scheduled a couple dates in India. They had to cancel one of them because apparently ticket sales were not strong enough. UK has proved to be a pretty strong live event market. I mean, the median income in India is way lower. So there's a lot less money to extract there from a ticket standpoint. But in the UK, if they did a stadium show, Lord knows it would be a hot ticket and they would generate a ton of revenue from selling tickets there. But in India, I think they would book a stadium and they would have a tough time selling tickets, and the tickets that they did sell would have to be at a pretty low price. Until the Indian economy grows, and I mean, clearly they have a strong fan base there, and that is their number two market. I mean, it's a massive population. There's a number of very large cities there. I think people are not so much willing to go see it live yet for whatever reason. But maybe that'll change in the future, but not anytime soon. So let's go. So that was jumping ahead into Q&A. Q&A happens later, of course. But we had a we're an hour 20 minutes into this thing. What we had, though, which we have had for a while, is the seminar from Nick Kahn, where he educates us about media. And one of his topics that he taught us about this time was about the state of mergers and acquisitions across the media space and beyond. So here's Nick Kahn's lesson on that topic.
Stephanie McMahon will further discuss gaming in a moment. Before that, we wanted to share our point of view on further consolidation in the gaming sector. First, like many of you, we are not surprised by this continued consolidation. Microsoft is making its biggest acquisition in its 46-year history, with its purchase of Activision Blizzard. Take-Two, one of our gaming partners, made its biggest acquisition in its 28-year history with its purchase of Zynga. Sony made moves to bolster its gaming division with its acquisition of Bungie. As Sony made it clear on their earnings call yesterday, we expect these companies to monetize the value of their newly acquired titles via scripted and unscripted content. The sector should end up with four, maybe five players emerging, and the winners will largely be dependent on their IP. As we've seen from Warner Discovery, Amazon MGM, and Univision Televisa, all of these are driven by content and distribution. This isn't just the major conglomerates. Penguin Random House and the New York Times have both made moves in recent months to scale their businesses through strategic acquisitions. We are even seeing theme park consolidation with the SeaWorld play on Cedar Fair. All said, we believe this consolidation trend will continue in 2022. We're all keeping our eyes on Dish and DirecTV, Nexstar, EA, and Lionsgate as they look to possibly enter into meaningful M&A conversations. Again, all content or platform plays.
So there's Nick Kahn giving us a lesson, but it all points to, look at how important content is. Look how important intellectual property is. And what does WWE have?
Intellectual property, IP.
And this is how badly companies need it, that they need to consolidate, they need to merge together and put their IP together so that they can, you know, get the content that they need to do the business that they need to do. And look at us. We've got lots of IP, so that makes us even more attractive. However, is he speaking in code here? Is he saying what I think he might be saying? Chris Gullo, you're a proponent of this idea. Is WWE for sale?
As we've seen in his previous comments, I think a sale will eventually happen, and it could happen during Vince McMahon's lifetime. And I know that you are 100%
no,
not for the
God no. damn it, no, but, give me it. It's mine.
But as Nick Kahn has said before, I don't think he's actively looking for, but I'm sure phone calls are coming in. But also what I see with this mergers and acquisitions, we see companies buying companies that make products similar to what they're like. You know, you see video, you know, Microsoft, you know, acquiring companies that make video games that they put on their platforms to kind of, for lack of better words, cannibalize the market. Now PlayStation can't have games under, you know, Activision or whatever it might be. WWE, I guess, could do that, but how would they do that? Like, you know, what stuff could they purchase away that AEW wouldn't even have a shot at having, you know?
Well, I think the idea is that somebody who needs their IP, somebody who probably owns a media platform or has a, I don't know, I always look at Endeavor. I wanted to wait to get to this, but like look at Endeavor acquired UFC. There's a lot of ways that that works out for Endeavor, probably, that I don't deeply understand. Could Nick Khan sell WWE to CAA? I was looking into how big is CAA. Cursory Google search tells me that CAA makes about $500 million a year. So that's like half of what WWE generates. So I don't know if CAA is big enough. CAA is not a publicly traded company, so there's a limited amount of information. CAA is Nikon's former employer. It is a talent agency, but it makes about $500 million a year. WWE makes $1 billion a year. So I don't know. Maybe they merge. It's probably not going to happen, but maybe that's a possibility. Anyway, Brandon Ross of Lightshed in the Q&A, he pressed Nikon. He wants to know, are you saying what I think you're saying?
Great. And then, Nick, in your introductory remarks, you opined on consolidation across TMT. I know that you're strategic when you write these scripts. So I was wondering if you were trying to message something there, or really how do you see WWE as a possible strategic piece in this M&A wave we're in? Then I have one more.
Sure. Thanks for the kind words. I don't know how strategic it is, just how organic it is. What the message we're trying to convey subtly or overtly is, it appears to us that every platform, every business wants to be in business in a material way with people who can create content, which we've been doing here, as you know, for 35 years plus. So we think, you know, there's even more buyers now, as we all know, than there were 3 years ago. We think in 2 years from now, there's going to be even more buyers than there are now. So that was what was reflected in those comments.
Yeah, that's all he was saying. I think Brandon Ross thinks that they want to sell, that Nick wants to sell. My prevailing belief, though, is that Vince McMahon will never let go of this company as long as he's alive and well. His health is good. If there's a problem with his health, maybe. If there's a day where Vince McMahon is no longer alive and somebody else is running this company, maybe they sell it. But I don't think that's going to happen. Maybe they can convince Vince that they can give him some sort of Dana White deal where Dana White's still in independent control of USC somehow. I don't know. But I think, in other people who I've talked to, who I think know what they're talking about, think that too.
Just for the chat, MJ, I do see your super chat. We're going to bring it up towards the end, along with Tim B's as well. They're kind of a little bit steered away from the topic. So,
okay. And then the next chapter of Nick Khan's seminar is he's talking about the value of live sports streaming, which I think is a really important topic for us to consider here when we're trying to understand what's the value of WWE's media rights and how and to what extent do streaming platforms play into this. It's obviously in WWE's interest for everybody to believe that live sports is going to be bought by streaming properties. But here's Nick Khan saying, look, it's a big deal right now.
Finally, we want to touch on the latest movement in the sports rights space. We've discussed in the past how one of the biggest acquisition drivers for streamers is live rights. It's why Amazon, Peacock, Paramount Plus, and ESPN Plus and Hulu have spent billions over the past year to bring top-tier rights to their services. ESPN alone closed 7 major deals over the course of 10 months. Amazon, as we all know, recently spent over $10 billion to be in business with the NFL. And that deal is starting a season early. NBCU's $2.7 billion extension of the EPL was largely a Peacock play, with most of the inventory slotted for the streamer. ViacomCBS, in its first year, has recognized the value of live rights, shifting its UEFA Champions League programming to Paramount Plus on a near-exclusive basis and picking up rights for Serie A in the Europa League. We discussed Apple 3 quarters ago. It's just a matter of time for Apple. We all saw Netflix's Tricky Friday a few weeks ago. It's just a matter of time for Netflix. All of these aforementioned companies are more incentivized now to license content at increased prices from content originators.
So there's Nick Khan saying, you know, we know the NFL is mostly on linear TV. It's on NBC, it's on ESPN, it's on CBS, it's on Fox, it's on, I think I named them all, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, ESPN. But Prime Video, Amazon Prime Video is going to have the NFL starting next season, Thursday. It's going to be exclusive. Is that right? You probably know this better than I do. The Thursday night football is exclusively.
I believe so, yeah.
So it's Thursday night football has been on Fox and on the NFL Network up to this point. Is that correct?
CBS had it for a little bit too, I believe, if I remember correctly.
But I believe the new deal is Fox is letting go of that. They're just going to do their Sunday football and whatever playoff rights they get. And you're going to have Amazon Prime to watch Thursday night football in the US, which most people do have access to it, at least. Whether or not they're using it is another thing, because it's, you know, you're getting discounts on shipping because you have Amazon Prime. More people have Amazon Prime in this country than have a pet. Anyway, and we know the NBA is on ESPN and Turner. MLB is on Turner and ESPN and Fox Sports. I'm going over the major sports leagues in my head. NHL is on. He didn't mention this, actually. He could have. NHL is on Turner now and on ESPN, but mostly on ESPN Plus.
Yes.
So there you go. It's on streaming. And hey, look, you know, the Prime Video with Thursday Night Football. Peacock just renewed the Premier League, but he said, oh, the biggest piece of the Premier League deal is for them to put Premier League games on Peacock, which is news to me. Paramount Plus, the Viacom CBS property, has these. Are you familiar with any of these soccer leagues? UEFA, yes, Serie A, Europa League?
I'm familiar with Serie A. AC Milan fan myself. So I'm familiar with Serie A. UEFA and Europa, kind of, but like, and I know, like, what was it? The La Liga just had a huge media rights deal,
which too. Yeah.
He brought up in the quarter three earnings call. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's especially with the increased popularity of soccer in America, you know, we're seeing these rights get bigger and bigger as the acquisitions go.
And it's just a matter of time for Apple. There's reports that Apple's interested in Sunday Ticket and in some sort of live Major League Baseball rights. It's just a matter of time for Netflix. I wanted to point out, are you familiar with Netflix's Freaky Friday? Have you watched Freaky Friday on Netflix?
I have not.
What is he talking about here?
Let's see.
It took me a while to figure out. I was Googling like Netflix Freaky Friday, and I'm getting like the Lindsay Lohan movie and stuff like that.
That's what I'm thinking.
What he's talking about. And I should, I have Netflix stock, by the way. I should know this. Netflix lost a lot of value on Friday, January 21st, after it's probably its Thursday earnings call the day before. It went from over $500 a share down to just under $400 a share. So lost a lot of value. I became much poorer that day. Because, you know, I should know this better, but Netflix, its growth is in question. I think they do give projections or estimates on what they think the subscriber count is going to be for the following quarter. And they might have missed on that, or at least there's questions around their growth. But US Canada subs were up 2% sequentially in that quarter, Q4. Maybe there's Q1 that I'm missing. I don't think so. But anyway, there's questions around the growth for Netflix subscribers. I threw this chart together. Still a lot of growth in the Asia Pacific region. Some growth still happening in Latin America. Some growth still happening in Europe, where the Europe, Middle East, Africa region is basically equal to the US Canada region in terms of subs. But anyway, they're having challenges with their business, and some value that was baked into their business. Investors and analysts now think, oh, we're overestimating that and downgraded it. And now Netflix is down to $400 a share when it used to be at $500 a share. So what is Netflix going to have to do if they want to maintain subscribers and drive some more growth in their subscribers? What are they going to have to do? Maybe they're going to have to play in sports. So that's what Nick Khan is saying there. This is a conversation, an exchange between Nick Khan and Brandon Ross, talking about, you know, sort of the prospects for Raw and SmackDown rights on streaming platforms.
Gotcha. And then finally, in your introductory remarks, you also talked about the importance of the extra engagement that you've been able to build through Peacock versus when you own the WWE Network. And your last run SmackDown deal you did with Fox, and one of the reasons was because it provided you with the widest possible distribution. And as you look towards your renewals for Raw and SmackDown coming up in a couple of years, do you think that broadcast is still going to be the right avenue to pursue? Or with all of the eyeballs that are shifting to streaming, do you think that a streamer might be the way to go?
Couple things. You know, number one, we're extremely pleased with our partnership with Fox, and obviously we believe in what they're doing. If just off the top of our head, if you look at where the playoffs and finals of these sports live, and keep in mind, our playoffs and finals, our premium live events are living on Peacock, our regular season, if you will, on Fox and USA, Super Bowl upcoming in a week and change, NBC, NBA Finals, in June, ABC, the Final Four matchup, a combination of Turner and CBS. So we still think that you're seeing, you know, big event programming there. We won't dismiss or discount those buyers as to where the future's going. We think they're real. We also realize the world that we're all living in, where premium dollars are being paid for premium content, certainly not only on Peacock, but on all of the other streamers, as we know. When Vince, Steph, and company launched WWE Network in 2014, they really just had to be the second best after Netflix to be the second best in the world. And if you want to slide Hulu in there, then third best in the world. Now, as you know, it's a cluttered marketplace. So it made all the sense in the world to partner up with Peacock on that one, and we'll see. You know, we'll see where we are come the next rights deal.
So I'm a little bit confounded by Brandon Ross's premises here. So I guess what he's saying, this part makes sense. You know, I can make sense of this, that it's sort of around the question of how important is reach. And one of the reasons why going to Fox is a good idea is because Fox is in, I don't know, over 100 million homes. You don't have to have a cable subscription to have Fox. If you have a cable subscription, you definitely got Fox. So that makes SmackDown really widely available. It's important that a lot of people have access to our content because that benefits all of our downstream businesses, whether that's getting people to watch the premium live events, whether that's getting people to go to events, whether that's getting people to buy our consumer products, our merchandise, and our games and things like that. And I think what Brandon Ross is saying here is that how important is that reach when, look, people are watching linear TV less and are engaging in streaming more. I think that's a bit ahead of the curve. I think that's a lot ahead of the curve. And if we think about, we know from that Bologna report that, or not even from the Bologna report, from Comcast's latest report that Peacock has 9 million paid subscribers. They have an additional 7 million highly engaged subscribers who have access to Peacock for free because they are Comcast, Xfinity, or Cox communication subscribers. So they have, let's say, 16 million paying subscribers. By the way, you have to be a paying subscriber to watch the premium live events for WWE. You get very limited access to content otherwise. So that's 16 million households we could say that Peacock is being used in. Now there's more that aren't highly engaged. I guess it's a question of how many homes is Cox and Comcast in? And I know where I could look that up, but it's not as many households as have access to Fox and are going to have access to Fox for a long time to come. So I think we could pose this question too, is that what do you think has higher viewership? The premium live events right now, or SmackDown, or Raw for that matter? You know, we know Raw, just to establish what the viewership is, Raw did something like 1.7 million viewers on Monday. SmackDown against the Olympics on Friday looks to have done about 2.1 million viewers. Do we think the PLEs are doing that many viewers?
I mean, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
We don't have hard numbers. I have one I will no question. Then we have a fun super chat from MJMS. But the question I have on this is, we're talking a lot about next day air rights from this narrative, and I get that. But when we were just talking about sports TV deals, I was kind of looking up, and the next major deal to expire that's non-WWE looks to be the NBA, which is 2025. So in reality, WWE's TV deal.
After WWE.
Yeah. So in reality, WWE's TV rights deal would be the next big U.S. sport entertainment. And I think the bigger picture here is that when Nick Khan brings up something like Apple TV and stuff like that, that could be the avenue that they're going, that we could possibly see Raw or SmackDown on a streaming service at the next TV rights deal.
Maybe partly. I don't think completely. I mean, I could see some, hybrid or gradual distribution there, where I could see where some episodes of Raw are on Peacock and the USA Network. I think it's too early to put Raw and SmackDown on exclusively on a streaming platform. I think that would not be enough reach to help their other businesses. I think premium live events are behind a paywall on Peacock, because those were the events that traditionally the more hardcore fan wanted and was willing to pay a lot of money for. So it makes sense that you would put it behind a paywall. And it makes sense that you're getting a lot more money per event for them from NBC Universal than you are per event for Raw and SmackDown. Depending on how you do the math, but yeah, this is a little bit early, which, the Late Show guys do seem to be especially futuristic with some of their assessments of media.
Speaking of Brandon Ross, MJ had a fun super chat. Will Brandon Ross and VKM be on night one or night two of WrestleMania? And who goes overweight, he said. And then will we ever see a price target on a pull match?
Yes, this is a perfect segue for what happened at the end of this exchange between Brandon Ross and Nikon.
And your Super Bowl is on Peacock, right?
Yes, sir. So, WrestleMania. Are you coming this year, or are you not attending?
I hope to be there.
Perfect.
Well, thank you.
We have a special pile driver ready for you from the other day.
I bet you do.
Yeah.
I'll stay away from Vince. All right. Thanks.
Yeah.
So there you go. Interesting. He thinks that Nick wants to sell. I don't know. He's friend of the show, and I listen to the Light Shed podcast, and it's always really informative. I'm not sure I understand the media business in the same way, but maybe he understands it better. Now, I think you have a question for me, Chris Gall.
So the question I have for you is, did WWE release all these wrestlers just so they could reach $1 billion?
That's what it was all about, right? Vince and Nick, they sat in their room together and they were like, I want to make $1 billion, Nick. How can I do it? And Nick was like, well, let's just fire people. And he was like, yes, that's it. Perfect. That's essentially what happened, right?
No, I think, and then the narrative I know that we, when putting out your preview for this Q4 and year end, a lot of the narrative on the internet was, well, yeah, of course they reached $1 billion. They released all these people. Of course, that's why they did it. Hit budget and listen, like a lot of the releases we talked about it, like it, it was sad to see all those jobs lost, but I think earning $1 billion profit, It was part of the pie, but not the larger picture.
And I realize I've skipped a slide here. We'll go back to it in a moment.
Yes, that's why I wasn't ready for one yet.
Okay. So how much money did WWE make in revenue? Can you read this number for me, Chris Gull? Let's examine this notion about whether how much all the releases, which there were something like 80 of them, how much those releases in 2021 played into WWE's financial achievements, targets, whatever. People want this notion that, and look, there were 60 employees in one period during the spring who were fired for downsizing because they saw an opportunity to cut costs. They're a private company. Fair enough. They probably had severance payments on that too. But anyway, and that's about profitability. That's not about revenue. Anyway, but those are, you know, the employee headcount is way down, right? But nobody knows any of those faces. No wrestling fans know those faces. They know the 79, 80 faces who are released. And that has to, and the wrestlers I hear are believing this narrative too, that it's all part of this, you know, plan that they had because they wanted to, you know, hit certain financial targets, probably, or because they're getting ready to sell the company. They're getting ready to sell the company so that all of these things that happen to my friends or to these wrestlers who I like has some grander meaning. And I think that is wrestler and wrestling fan fiction, to apply greater meaning to this thing that is upsetting, that people are losing their jobs. It's just a matter of a realignment in their talent vision, which we're about to talk about, to give Vince talent that's not necessarily better, but talent that Vince is more likely to get behind. So let's jump to another exchange from the Q&A that is between JP Morgan analyst David Karnofsky and responses from Stephanie McMahon and Nick Kahn here.
Thanks for taking the question. Just one for Nick or Stephanie. You know, can you discuss in more detail the Next in Line program? Just interested to know how this is, you know, kind of different or improved relative to the way you traditionally recruited talent, you know, from some of the regional or smaller promotions.
Absolutely, David. This is Steph again, and thank you for the question. It is absolutely an evolution of our process. You know, the NIL program, I think, offers WWE more opportunity than any other brands who are partnering with these collegiate athletes because it is such a recruiting tool. You have, you know, elite level college athletes with big brands and personalities that, you know, otherwise wouldn't necessarily have a path forward. Think about how many people actually make it into the NFL or how many people actually make it into the NBA, et cetera. It's a very, very small pool, and you're left with some incredibly talented athletes who really have no options to move forward with their athletic careers, save for WWE. The NIL program now offers that pathway. We have a recruiting website tied to the NIL program, and not only the athletes that we have under contract, but now all of the athletes who follow those athletes are going to be coming into the pipeline, and we have been seeing a number of college athletes signing up on our tryout site.
I would also add into that, David, just off the top of our heads, Big E, University of Iowa, Roman Reigns, Georgia Tech, Dwayne Johnson, University of Miami, Goldberg, University of Georgia. It's those folks just one step away from making it to the NFL who are amazing athletes, big personalities that we think can cross over. So why not get involved in their lives at an early stage? It made all the sense in the world to us.
So, yeah, I think part of this is giving Vince talent that he's more likely to be interested in using. but what do you think of this NIL program? Is this a good idea? Is this really, independently of Vince's preferences, a good idea?
I mean, you know, my personal creative opinion, I think you get talent from all avenues. If you're going to solely base on this, yeah, sure, you're going to end up with Roman Reigns and you know, and Goldbergs and stuff like that. But he also didn't list all the people that were college athletes and never worked out. All those people they brought into OVW and FCW and NXT over the years that were straight from college sports. I think you need a good mix of base. I mean, I get where they're doing on this, you know, and they're trying to beat other avenues to get athletes. Like, for example, let's just bring up Gable Stevenson. Definitely a guy that probably could have made a career out of the UFC, right? Probably.
If he was interested, yeah, for sure.
If he was interested, yeah. Amazing and trust. And I think he mentioned that they were interested in him. But WWE beat him to the punch. So, I mean, I could see for them, they're probably seeing this as they can beat other competitors who would want these college athletes to the punch.
Yeah, I guess the critique that makes sense here is about kind of what you were touching on, is the hit rate. The hit rate with people who don't have prior wrestling experience may be lower than it is for people who do have wrestling experience. That's not to dismiss that you will get some people, like Nick Khan mentioned, Roman Reigns, Big E, Goldberg, who am I leaving out? The Rock, of course. But you will miss a lot of people. Now, they're not going to completely stop using independent wrestlers, apparently. They still have done a tryout. They did one tryout since introducing the NIL program. But if you're going to recruit those people less, you're missing a lot of talent that could be hits for you, who would have a higher hit rate probably. But on the other hand, so this is where this starts to depart from reality, or depart from what I think is good talent assessment, is that, yeah, Vince is just not going to use people like that. He's not going to use Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, Johnny Gargano to their potential. Sami Zayn, Kevin Owens, he's not using them. He's not using Roman Reigns hasn't used Roman Reigns to his potential. He's becoming a pretty effective star right now. But look at those 5 years where, anyway, not using Baron Corbin to his potential, I would argue. Anyway, that's what's happening there. So that's what they're doing. They're serving the master. So let's talk about a couple analyses from stock analysts, which came out from JP Morgan, from David Karnofsky, who we just heard in the Q&A.
Yep. So this is the investment thesis from Karnofsky. Following agreements to license the WWE Network to Peacock and NXT to USA, WWE's domestic distribution is largely set for the next several years. Further increases to 2022-2023, OEBITDA estimates are unlikely in the near term given a lack of visibility into the investment spend or potential deals to license to the WWE Network abroad. At the same time, continuing mixed ratings, performance, and competition from AEW may weigh in on the multiple.
Yes. So what I wanted to focus on here is continued mixed ratings, performance, and competition from AEW may weigh on the multiple. The multiple that he's talking about there, and this is from Morgan Stanley, not from JP Morgan, but the multiple is what is used to determine what the stock price should be. Basically, they're taking the forward-looking 4 quarters of EBITDA, not to be confused with OEBITDA, OEBITDA, which is similar. So this is another profit metric that's similar. They're taking the forward-looking 4 quarters of EBITDA and multiplying that by some multiple. And then from that, we get their market capital. And from their market capital, we can divide that by outstanding shares and get the stock price. Long story short, Morgan Stanley points out that here are some other peers of WWE, Warner Music Group, Live Nation, Endeavor, the parent of UFC, and Liberty Media, which is the Formula One company. They all are valued at far higher multiples of their forward-looking EBITDA than WWE is, by more than double in some cases. I mean, the next nearest low multiple to WWE here is about 20x in the form of Endeavor, and Ben Swinburne's got this listed as 9.6x for WWE. But anyway, this is all boring math. Nobody's going to understand what I'm talking about. But let's get into where did I have? Yeah. So let's look at what I think the EBITDA is. So let's try to get to here's where our goal is here. Let's try to get to what should WWE stock price be. Right now, WWE stock price as of the close of the market is almost $52, $51.71. As you mentioned, Chris Gull, the market capital, the value of all of the WWE shares, all added up at $51.72, are valued at $3 billion, $3.92 billion, almost $4 billion. So if we do this formula where we take the forward-looking EBITDA, and let's try to figure out what their stock price would be. Now, according to the scientists here at WrestleNomics headquarters, who have been more accurate than the analysts last three quarters, we think that the forward-looking EBITDA for WWE is $331 million. Now, if we add Morgan Stanley's listed multiple of 9.6, we get $3.18 billion. So that doesn't sound right. So I don't know if that's old or where he's getting that from. But what we need, the multiple that we need to get to the current value is 11.8. So if we multiply 331 times 11.8, then we do get something that is very close to WWE's market cap. Now, if we take the next nearest multiple that Morgan Stanley has listed there, which is for Endeavor, which is at a 19.9x? Let's make sure that's right. 19.9x. The others are even higher. Live Nation is at 24.7x. Warner Music Group is at 20x of their forward-looking EBITDA. So anyway, let's go with the lowest one that we've got here besides WD. Let's go with 20x, which is what Endeavor's multiple is. And let's multiply forward-looking EBITDA of $331 million times 20. And that gives us a market cap of $6.62 billion. $6.62 billion. Now, if we, let's put this 6.62 billion dollars. Let's divide that by, there's roughly 76 million basic shares. That would give us a stock price of $87. But why is the multiple low? Because of, according to JP Morgan, a different analyst, from David Karnofsky from JP Morgan, it's affected maybe by other factors, but affected by, you know, their questionable ratings performance. SmackDown's been doing okay lately in my assessment, but Raw has had its challenges, but we're going to see what Raw is going to do now without the football competition, but, and competition from AEW. So is AEW, at least in the assessment of this analyst, competition from AEW is dragging down WWE's multiple. One reason why WWE might be taking competition from AEW seriously. I don't know if that information goes so far and reaches Vince McMahon, but that's a reality, I think. You know, the stock price would be higher if not for AEW, because at least one analyst would put that multiple up a bit higher, and that would raise his stock price target a bit.
Sorry. And I think AEW becomes true competition. You know, I mentioned earlier about the TV rights deal. I think AEW is the same year as SmackDown's, right? Expiring, I believe.
I'm sorry, say that again.
AEW's TV right deal for at least Dynamite is expiring the same year as SmackDown's.
Raw and SmackDown expire at the same time, September 2024. AEW's TV deal for both Dynamite and Rampage will expire, if WarnerMedia picks up the one-year option, will expire December 2024. So one quarter later.
You know, that'll be very interesting how similar those deals are, if, you know, we talked about in the past. But yeah, I know you're about to cue in here. For Morgan Stanley, this is Ben Swinburne. With respects to WWE's upcoming domestic rights renewal, where we currently expect a 1.5 times AAV increase, we see a wide range of outcomes, both in rights fee increase as well as future distribution partners, with more streaming players potentially bidding on these rights, which we've seen from Nick Khan kind of alluding to that in the last couple of earnings calls.
Yeah. So if we assume so what they're basically what Morgan Stanley, what Ben Swinburne is saying here is we're baking into our estimate in the new deal term, which would begin October 2024. We're assuming that they can get a 1.5x increase. The current deals are the result of a 3.6x increase. So basically that's how much value growth there are left in these media values is their basic assumption. You know, you can make bull and bear cases. And in fact, I think Morgan Stanley does, but 1.5x. And I think that's a fair, I think I would agree with that. I think when I did my estimate, I assumed a 1.5x. So current AAV for Raw and SmackDown combined is $470 million a year. That's just in the US. That's how much money they're getting for a year on average across this 5-year deal for Raw and SmackDown. $470 million. Let's put that in some perspective. New Japan's best revenue year before the pandemic was about $50 million in US dollars. This is just WWE's Raw and SmackDown deal is worth 10 times New Japan's best year ever. So anyway, if we multiply that amount by 1.5 times, we get to $705 million per year. Remember, WWE just registered $1 billion in a year. So imagine how, if that comes to fruition, or if imagine they get an even bigger multiple on their media rights values, you know, it's not inconceivable to think that this company could pull in $1 billion just in U.S. rights if they got a really favorable multiple, if there was a lot of competition for this, as Nick Khan continues to hype about how streaming platforms are going to need live sports. They're going to need our live content. They're going to need our IP. So everybody's going to be bidding for us. We'll see. We'll see. And then.
Yeah, so now we have WWE revenue by geography, and this is pretty much, how's the international business? We talked a lot about domestic, you know, business here, but how is the international business in, you know, Europe and Middle East, Africa, Asia, Pacific, Latin America, and, you know, North America when it comes to like Mexico and Canada?
Yes. So this is looking back from 2016 to the present. WWE updated this with their latest annual report. And we see that 80% of WWE's revenue is from North America, mostly from the U.S. We have this bulge in the middle from Europe, Middle East, Africa that starts in 2018. And then when the new TV deals go into effect, it the bulge kind of goes away. But the dollar amount does go away in 2020 because there was just one Saudi event. So that increase is from the Saudi events. And that will grow in future years. I you know, one thing that Nick Khan mentioned in his interview with Colin Cowherd around WrestleMania time is that he sees Latin America, he sees Mexico as this big opportunity for them because there's a wrestling market there. And look at 1%. And this is not even, you go back before the pandemic, go to 2018, go to 2019, 1% of the revenue was coming from Latin America. I think it also reflects how little money there is relative to other regions, how little money there is in TV rights in that region. Because I can't imagine what other money is there. They didn't go to Latin America in 2020 or 2021, and they're reporting $11 million, $12 million. So that gives you a pretty clean idea of the media value that they're extracting there. Some of it would be consumer products, some merchandise sales, I guess. I wonder how game purchases would even be accounted for there, but probably that's a pretty good reflection of the media value in that region for them is something around $10 million, I would think, just for TV rights in that region. You know, could compare that to the US, which we just mentioned, in a year is 470. India is about $50 million. So there's that. Those are all my thoughts. We're not going to do YouTube this week because we're over 2 hours here.
I will bring up Timby's super chat that he sent earlier. He goes, are there any recent SEC filings pertaining to Shane McMahon's compensation? And he says, asking for a friend who thinks he might be showing up on Wednesday.
I tweeted this earlier this week. So we will get an update on Shane McMahon's compensation and on Paul Levesque's compensation and Stephanie's compensation and Nick's compensation. Vince's new son, Nick. We'll get an update on that. It took them all the way to April to file that last year. So it could be as late as April, but usually so I'm talking about the proxy statement. The proxy statement has come out in March or even February in other years. So Shane is not an executive. He's not an employee, according to those proxy statements. He has not been an employee or had any corporate role in WWE since he left WWE in his corporate role in 2009. And what gets disclosed is his compensation as a performer. And I'm looking for the excerpt that I tweeted the other day. So we have it here. If I drop it into here, will it appear? I think
how much shares does he? Does he still own a large amount of shares?
Shane McMahon was given many, many shares. Shane McMahon was given well over 1 million shares, the same as Stephanie has. Shane sold all of his shares by 2014. I think he had two big selling periods, one after he left the company and then one in 2014 or so, which I imagine he's invested into his other businesses. But Shane,
so just a talent contract like anyone else that was correct. Let go.
He's not a shareholder anymore. Because if he had shares, I believe it would be getting disclosed here in the proxy statement because it had been disclosed in the past when he did have shares. So he has no shares, as far as I believe. He got $820,000 as a performer in 2020. That was his pay last 2 years ago. So we'll get an update on what his pay was in 2021 in a month or two.
All right. Andrew Zarian, thank you for the super chat. Just saying, fantastic combo. Thank you.
Thank you. I think I'm going to be talking with Andrew Zarian later today.
Yeah, you're a busy man, Brandon. Very busy man. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, and I think that
were there MJ super chats that we didn't address yet?
Oh, no, we did. He just really wanted that Brandon Ross one to discuss. So,
okay.
I think we got them all. I'll just do one more scan. But yeah, no, I believe we got all the super chats. Yep.
Okay. Big plug. As people may know, I did the Pro Wrestling Industry Report that has been completed. That is, if you're a patron, you already have access to it. Just go to patreon.com/WrestleNomics. If you haven't looked at it yet, you can get access to it by becoming a patron for $5 a month, patreon.com/WrestleNomics. Or if you don't want to do the Patreon thing, you can buy it for $5.99 on PayHip. The link is pinned to the top of the WrestleNomics Twitter account. It'll if you're listening on audio, we'll put it in the description. So that's all. Hit the thumbs up, because that really helps our algorithm. We have merch at store.postwrestling.com. Thursday, I'll be back with the live TV ratings talk right here on the WrestleNomics YouTube channel. You can make your prediction for what you think the AEW Dynamite demo rating is going to be this week in the post-wrestling Discord in the WrestleNomics channel. We thank post-wrestling for being amazing partners, as always. What plugs do you have, Chris Cole?
Just check out my other podcast, Rediscovering the Indies, on all your major podcast platforms, RTA Pod on Twitter, Rediscovering the Indies on Instagram and Facebook. Our most recent episode was released last week. Dusty Rhodes, Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling. Lots of fun stuff in there, including Fake Goldust. Cody Rhodes making his professional wrestling debut as a referee. But I think my favorite part about it was Dusty Rhodes thinking he was going to get a TV deal with Turner South for Turnbuckle Championship Wrestling, when Turner clearly had a no-compete clause with WWE to have any wrestling. So,
wow. I remember Turner South from Extreme Warfare Revenge.
Yeah, well, Dusty hosted the Classics, the WCW Classic show on there.
Interesting.
And that was his connection to try to get that deal. And Classics actually aired until, I think, fall of 21. Which
so they could air old content, but they couldn't air new content?
Yeah, and I don't know if that was just because that was the end of that deal, but yeah, I could be wrong. I believe it aired till fall of 21, but I could be wrong.
Okay, that's all for this week. Thanks to everybody.
2001, I mean. Not 21, 2001, sorry.
Gotcha. Thanks to everybody for listening, for tuning in. Thanks to everybody for your super chats. Thanks to all of our subscribers on Patreon, of course. See you on Thursday. We'll talk to you the same place next week.